Greetings, race community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Chip Edmonds, who serves as president. That's right, president at Lycoming College. Welcome, Chip.
Thank you so much, Brent. It's good to be with you, my friend. Thanks for including me today.
I'm excited to reconnect with you. And for everybody listening, you might be wondering, why is there a president on the Race podcast? Well, before Chip was a president, he was an advancement leader, and I think represents a growing trend of advancement leaders that are ultimately moving into the senior leadership role of president. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. But before we do, I want to start like I do every episode. Chip, take me back to junior year of high school. Who was that guy and what led you to Lycoming College?
Well, thank you, Brent. It's fun to harken back on those experiences and what really informed my decision about college. I don't know about you, Brent, but I had a really actually positive high school experience. And I knew of Lycoming because my parents were also grads, but it was not until my high school soccer coach said to me, hey, the coach at Lycoming is interested in you and would like to offer you a roster spot at the college. It was in that moment that I thought, okay, I think this is a place that I'm going to take very seriously. But I was someone who loved to do a lot of things. And what I knew most about my college experience was that I wanted to be able to study hard. I wanted to be able to do all the things that I love to do beyond the classroom. And I went for my tour and I went for my visit. And I found that indeed it was a place where I could not only have an exceptional academic career, but also do those things on the athletic field, on the stage, and the like that Lycoming would afford. So
well,
it was a great fit.
Sharing that you're somebody with a lot of interest, it makes a little more sense because I've hosted over 200 leaders on this podcast, and never once have I seen Bachelor of Arts, History, Music, and Business Administration. So you're a Renaissance man. Tell me more about that trio.
Well, thanks for that invitation to share a little more about it. You know, you're right. I do have a lot of interests. And for much of my life, I never quite wanted to give any of them up. So you could say I'm a jack of all trades and master of none. But in reality, what I think drove much of that was that being in different communities, being in different activities, being in different spaces where people see the world differently, they prioritize different things, they have different loves and passions. Gosh, you see the world better and more richly, and you just gain so many wonderful experiences and encounters with people. And at the heart of a college experience, I think that's what you should aim for as you look to the ways in which you can lead and work in the world. And so I think that has sort of informed my love of lots of different things.
Here's the thing that totally resonates with me, Chip. But now I'm a dad, and I've got an 11-year-old, a 9-year-old, and a 6-year-old. And this tension between specialization versus exploration and being a jack of all trades and learning and trying a bunch of things. We are feeling it right now. Literally this week, my wife and I were talking, we got to be more focused. And it's like, but they're 11, 9, and 6. And this should be a time of exploration. And now you're in a position as a leader of a college where you've got to see that tension all throughout the enrollment journey through graduation and beyond. How do you think about it today, as it clearly was a valuable formative part of your experience?
Yeah, you. I think you've captured something that really is a phenomenon around specialization. And specialization, depending on when that occurs, it's not simply that it's limiting, but it makes you feel as if there's a certain area where you should and have the expertise. And it actually, I think, sometimes can be limiting if you specialize too early because you actually are not as comfortable being uncomfortable. And part of learning, part of growing is making sure that you are doing different things across different contexts. And man, where's the richness? I would suggest, where's the richness around academic growth? It's in that interdisciplinary space. It's where you're seeing the ties across areas. And even, you know, I know we've talked a little bit about athletics already. I know you're a football guy. Well, you know, how important is it? Or have you heard about athletes that continue to play multiple sports later into their lives and how much better they become at a sport that they might specialize in later? I think there are bigger rules for life around that too.
Well, and you just said it, you know, being comfortable, being uncomfortable, which is, I think, a critical part of leadership. And man, we just had a battle recently. And if my son ever listens to this, he is going to cringe right now. But my 11-year-old loves to sing. And there's an elective when you enter sixth grade where you either do singing or art. And he really said he wanted to do art. All of his friends were doing art. But I know that he doesn't have nearly the interest he has in art that he has in music and singing. You can't get in the car. He takes over the radio. He picks the music. He's singing. But the idea of singing in front of other people, no way. And so we sort of challenged him, pushed him, you know, negotiated, and he started doing it. And most frustrated he's ever been with me, for sure.
I love hearing that
And
story.
then 2 weeks in, he came and he said, "You know what, Dad, it's actually going okay." Like,
Beautiful.
and then he came back and he said, "I just had a great day." And we had 2 weeks of just pain and frustration and fighting. And it's like, man, it is hard to push like that. But then when you see somebody getting comfortable being uncomfortable, it makes me sort of, yeah, just question that specialization versus having more experiences like that.
Yeah, I love that example, and I'll note one of the most awesome experiences that I've had so far is getting to address the first year class. So at our first year convocation, you know, being able to stand before this wonderful group of new students who are eager and excited to have that college experience, and to say to them, "Learn to do hard things. Get comfortable," as I've already said, comfortable being uncomfortable, because it is in those moments of vulnerability where you can explore the depths of who you are. It's when you're more open to what others are experiencing, and more inclined to continue to engage well in a myriad of things. And so, you know, if think about, we like to think that once we're adults, we don't get afraid of anything anymore. It's really not true. In fact, I have so many faculty, and I spent some time down in Charlotte talking about enrollment at the National Small College Conference, and it literally the title of my remarks were "Enrollment, It's Everybody's Business." And what are some of the hurdles to faculty and others on your campus getting involved? Is they're afraid that they might not know actually how to do that work really well because they're so comfortable being specialists at something and being really excellent at something. Well, in reality, when you try those things, you find that, hey, I can do this too. And you can not simply gain confidence, but provide a different perspective and way of seeing things that I think is really vital.
Well said. And so take me back to your own breadth of experiences and tell me just a little bit about your interest in history, music, and business during your college experience.
Well, the closest I got to knowing what I thought I wanted to do before actually ending up in higher education was the thought that I wanted to be an attorney. And I wanted to read and write as well as I could, but also encounter difficult texts, difficult books, difficult ideas, things that didn't have easy or simple answers. And so that's where I really dug in on history. And I found that in the faculty at Lycoming College, that these were history that said, you know, it's not simply about writing a really long paper. It's about, can you actually concisely say what you need to pay, say in 2 pages? So I'm gonna give a shout out to Dr. Bob Larson, who learned and taught us how to say what you can say in 5 pages in two. And that's a really important life skill, and way to interpret and understand and analyze information in a way that can be clearly communicated. So that was powerful. And for me, I loved making music. That was to perform and to travel the world. It was something that I knew I could do for a lifetime.
So
And
tell me
so,
more
you
about
know.
that favorite musical experiences from that era.
All right. So I guess I'll harken back to choir tour. My junior year, Lycoming had a long tradition of a choir that went toured every year, but went abroad every 3 years. And so I spent time in Germany, Poland, and the Czech Republic. You know, being with those groups where they, you know, you might know this, Brent, but you know what? The largest, historically, the largest for I don't mean historically. I mean for a long period of time, the largest social organizations that have existed around the world. Choirs.
Amazing.
So you want to see that in the middle of Europe and how people encounter and are festive and have, big pints of beer and a big bratwurst together in fellowship while making music. That's a pretty rich experience.
I love it. I love it. What a great memory. And then business, and you've got to turn all of that, put it in a blender, and then go do something after you
Yes.
graduate. So where did
Yeah. Well, business was sort of a, believe it or not, my kind of natural inclination. My brain is sort of functionally thinks like that. I, you know, from the time I was from the time I was pretty young, I was interested in earning money, how to earn money. I'd go on a trip and you'd get a per diem of dollar amounts and I'd come back with more than I left with and I'd eat other people's lunches because I didn't want to spend my own money. So that was my default. So I thought, I need to get beyond that default to explore other things that were really important to me. I also wanted some academic founding and grounding in that space. So taking a basic accounting course, taking things that help you understand how to read a balance sheet, because as not only an advancement, but higher education is indeed a place that we know we live and we function on mission. But if we don't have the resources and we don't acknowledge that we are a business in one fashion, then we can't actually live fully into our mission. And so that has sort of been an undergirding piece of who I am, and it's certainly reflected in the things I have enjoyed studying over the years.
And so how do you turn all of that into a first job out of college?
That's great. That's a really good question. Well, for me, it was an invitation to a first job, and it was not the first job that I thought I wanted. As I said, I thought I would either go to law school or I was going to go back and work in sales or in business, that end of things. And it was in the fall of my senior year, and I was invited to think about a job in higher education. And they said to me, we'd like you to finish out this year, do an internship, and then you'd need to stay on for at least a year after that. And I thought, my heavens, a whole nother year. Like at 22, you feel like that's a long period of time. Ultimately, I said yes to that invitation. And I think all of us, first of all, we need to, when we're early in our careers, when we're thinking about stuff, we need to be receptive and put ourselves in places where we might get invited to do something pretty cool. And for me, that was pretty powerful. And I still believe strongly in the notion of invitation. And I think it's incumbent upon us now as leaders to see talented people and invite them to do cool things that you think will help help change the world.
When did you find out advancement was a job?
All right, so this is a fun one. My first gig or encounter in advancement was being a support to a very august but older member of the Board of Trustees. He was an emeritus member and really sort of needed support getting around a retreat, a board retreat that was occurring. And so as a young kid who was clearly committed to enrollment at the time, but also, had spent a lot of time with people on campus. I was invited by a college president at that time to work with Dr. Gibbs McKinney. And Dr. McKinney was a guy who had a lot of fun, but worked really hard as an attorney. He also loved cars, another passion of mine. And what I encountered in that was work that was about understanding the passions and the things that drive and motivate people that have been successful in their lives and are at the point where they're ready to think about doing something that affects lives beyond their own. And that's where I really began to see, oh, you know what? This is meaningful, powerful work. And so I thank Dr. Gibbs McKinney.
And so, really, it sounds like starting in a customer service sort of role in a engagement concierge, whatever you want to call it, which is a critical part of the work. When did you actually join that org chart? And what was the progression of roles?
Yeah, the first time I stepped into advancement formally was on the annual giving side. And I did that down south at Duke University. Again, it was an invitation,
What
but
was
I
it?
got.
Can I ask, was it hard to leave Lycoming or was it time?
You know, it was hard, but also it was time. And I thought, from my own professional experiences, this goes leans into what we were saying earlier, getting comfortable being uncomfortable. And I thought I need to do some other things that get me uncomfortable again. And so at two or three different points in my career have put myself in new and different communities in order to do that. And I think it's still a commitment even today to step into places and even from learning my academic trajectory. I was not one of those who was done by 25 in terms of getting my terminal degree. I did my undergraduate degree. I worked for 4 years. I went back full time for a master's degree, worked a little more, and then finally finished my terminal degree at the University of Pennsylvania. But all of those mark moments where you say, it's time to get uncomfortable again.
I love it. And so when you evolve from the annual giving role, you then did a bunch of work as a frontline development officer at both Lycoming and Yale. And just tell me about the life as a road warrior, memorable visits, trips, lessons learned along the way.
Major gift work is really rewarding work, and it was the first time I really was in a space and place where you have a lot of agency and a lot of autonomy, and you often have very few moments that someone else is plugging in or measuring how you're doing. And so I found that as gift officers, as major gift officers in particular, you have to be very motivated. And you have to remain focused on what will really lead to the best results for you and ultimately the organization. And that's what I loved. I found that I really loved a lot about being gift officer. In fact, I still say now that whenever I step down from this role, that's what I see doing for as long as I can imagine. I would just love to have a portfolio of donors that I get to engage and ask and invite them to do great things for the institution. So, that it was it evolved quite a bit, but it was in some ways it was also entrepreneurial. The way you could think differently about what might engage someone to step in and lean into the institution versus someone else. It also informed when I got into leadership roles in advancement of how to even design portfolios. I found it really hard stepping into roles where you'd have a portfolio that's fully discovery, and you don't have anybody in that portfolio that's already giving to the institution or has a strong connection, whatever. And so even designing and building portfolios that have discovery, that have mature donors, that have folks who are largely in a stewardship kind of role. We all need to be flexing these muscles as gift officers and not relegate that to our newbies.
Well said. And then you had the opportunity to step into the vice president role pretty early in your career. And just tell me a little bit about lessons learned as a, let's call it, young leader. There's a lot of folks listening to this podcast who want to be on that track. And it was unique for you at your alma mater. But just tell us more about sort of stepping into that role, because very different than being a frontline fundraiser.
100%. And I have a very distinct memory of one of the questions that I was asked when interviewing for that vice president for advancement job. And it was still remains fairly striking to me because you're right. Prior to that, I had really been in increasing roles in fundraising, but had really not managed or overseen an entire team in this way. And I got the question, well, clearly you've had a lot of success fundraising, but how would you manage a team? And I had kind of anticipated the question, but how I responded then, like 20 years ago, is not quite 20, 16 years ago, is really how I continue to respond today. And that is, as a leader, I believe strongly in hiring and working with really capable people, doing all that you can to help them be successful, getting out of their way when they have when they have the when they have the clear directives and the objectives and goals that have been laid out for them, but then lean in and come alongside when there are hurdles to be removed. I believe that that when people enter into a role, that they want to do a darn good job. And if you don't start with that fundamental belief in the people that you hire and with whom you work, you're going to have a tough time. If you think that folks are in there and their natural inclination is they don't really want to work hard or they're looking for shortcuts, then I think it becomes a harder to inspire and encourage the people with whom you work. So I sort of someone who've always believed in the goodness of people and the dignity of each other and the fact that we want to use our labor in a way that makes the world better. So that continues to inform how I lead, and I think it's central to other really capable people wanting to work with you.
During that course of time, you've seen there's been a lot of change. We'll get into some of that in a bit here, but what are some of the moments or impact areas when you can start to sort of see the work come full circle? Not everybody gets that opportunity, but you've had a lot of seeds that were planted in 2009 or 2010 that now are being realized. And whether that's at an individual student level or programmatic level, are there philanthropic journeys, I guess, you've been a part of that really resonate with you at this point?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for asking that, Brent. I have many stories that stand out, and to be at the table or sitting on the couch, as it were, next to folks as they're thinking about these really big decisions, and making extraordinary investments in your institution. It's very humbling. In fact, just one aside before I go to the one fun, most poignant memory. I had a board of trustees member when I first came on into the role 16 years ago, and I said, "Thank you so much for your gift." And he said, "Hold on a minute, that was not a gift. It was an investment. And so when I make this investment, I expect to see that mature." And I continue to use and remind myself that that many, and this is language I know that you and Evertrue have used for years. We are all investing in ways, and it's seeing how we invest in a bigger, better way when it comes to philanthropy. So that was one little reminder. But one of the most powerful stories was a gentleman who came to Lycoming College from Mexico, from a very connected, well-to-do family there, had decided late in his high school career that he wanted to go to school in the States. Ended up flying their family's jet into Williamsport Airport, and in the dark of night, he thought, based on our map, which we are very close, like 3 hours to New York City. I think seeing on a map, he thought, I could do a jaunt over to New York City. But anyway, came as a student, had an extraordinary experience. Was a political science and economics double major, went on to be in the financial sector for years, but then got into politics in Mexico. And as a politician, he rose all the way to the governor of the state of Puebla. He was a senator for the country of Mexico. And tragically, he and his wife went down on Christmas Eve in their helicopter and passed away, very young and bright. Governor Rafael Moreno Valle Rosas, and for our community, fairly really very rocked by that occurrence. But it was in the moment of his father coming to Lycoming College and saying that Lycoming was the place that changed his life, that set him on this trajectory, and so we want to give a very meaningful seven-figure gift to establish a new scholarship, but it must be with two intents. Some student, and these are his words, who is very poor, but also very bright. And so it's been a just privilege to be able to see that scholarship play out over years of inviting a student who financially may not have a chance, but that we get to make that possible for a student who pays no tuition to come to Lycoming because of
I
that
mean,
scholarship.
thank you so much for sharing and such a poignant example. Not everything around philanthropy can you trace things in such a direct way, but to sort of be able to see the kid today that is benefiting from that whole journey and really sort of having something like that, paying it forward in perpetuity is what it's all about.
Indeed, indeed, Brent. It is those moments where you feel quite fortunate and grateful and blessed to be doing the work that we get to do.
But here's the thing: you hear examples, you have lived examples like that. Every fundraiser I meet has their version of that story, and then you open up the headlines, and it's higher ed this, the declining value, ROI, student loan, AI, et cetera, et cetera. And it just feels like there are issues, there are challenges, there are valid critiques, but there are so many incredible stories like the one you just shared that it just feels like the narrative is always out of balance. And maybe it's because negative headlines get clicks. I don't know, but I'm just curious because you must have to, right, make the case constantly, in your leadership role now.
Yeah, you're so right, Brent. And I love that you sort of acknowledge the balance. But and that is, if higher education isn't continually about being better and being reflective and acknowledging shortcomings, well, you know, then perhaps we are worthy of that criticism. But what I find time and again is that what we have amassed in many of our higher education institutions are people that are curious. People that don't believe we've yet have all of the answers. And indeed, there are times when we want to make sure that we're leaning in and adequately preparing our students for the careers and demands of this world. I think we take great pride in that in general. But it has also been extraordinary of late how we've have seen extraordinary amounts of criticism around the work that we do. And to be honest, I think what is most powerful is narrative and actual stories that counter those kinds of messages. Because in reality, when you connect, whether you want to do any economic study that has ever presented itself, or you want to look at life and longevity, you want to look at people who contribute culturally to the world, you want to look at folks who give back from a service and humanity standpoint, look at some of the organizations and the companies that have been created as an outgrowth of higher education. And it's hard to argue the extraordinary impact that our institutions play in our lives, in our society, in our nation and world. So, you know, to see that from a bird's eye view is very powerful, but we need to lean into those narratives and stories that counter those messages that are all too often in our midst.
And tell me about your role as president and how that intersects with advancement. In fact, before you do that, I want to know the area where you felt like you had the most to learn, sort of stepping into that role, and then also how you're able to build on the expertise around the fundraising world.
Yeah. Well, rather than picking just one area where I think I've had a lot to learn, because there are a few, you know, coming from really the revenue side of the house, I was on advancement and enrollment for the most part, had been very approximate to some of our academic programs. I did not come from the classroom side of the house, so I feel as if, you know, that's an area that I want to be a very good student and listen well to my colleagues there. But in general, and this is true for me in particular, but I think there's some larger messages, and that I've stepped into a presidency after being at an institution for 16 years. I could have easily said, I know this place, I know its people, I know the challenges, I know the opportunities, but I've been very intentional to sit down and meet with every academic department, taking time to engage with different administrative units and begin to see the place from a different perspective and a different lens. Even the things that someone is inclined to share with me as a chief advancement officer is very different from what they are inclined to share, or what they need to voice when I'm all of a sudden in a new and different role. My approach has been to engage from a sense of I do not have all the answers. Even in a place where, I could safely maybe choose that lane. But my approach is to be a lifelong learner. And I'm excited for the ways that advancement has prepared me to think that way. There's no question in my mind that committing my time to be with those who have the greatest interest and capacity to make our ambitions possible will be an area of joy.
Tell me about, I mean, mentorship's a big theme in our podcast. Just tell me about some of the mentors who have guided you along the way and what advice you'd have for others who are listening to this saying, wow, maybe I could do that someday. Maybe I could go from my role in Major Gifts to leadership and consider a president role that I might not have thought of before. You don't get there without great mentors.
Yeah, you are 100% right. The folks that I remember and think of most fondly as mentors have been those who have seen things in me before I saw them in myself. That started with my own upbringing, but then as I got older, my college experience as a young professional, people that took time and interest to acknowledge genuine and authentic pieces about me, I chose them as mentors. And I believe strongly that it's hard as someone who wants to mentor others or hope you can do that, I don't get to choose who my mentees are necessarily, but I do get to choose my mentors. And so over the years, it has been people who have leaned in and taken interest and seen the good and capacity in others. Those are the folks that I have been drawn to. And I'll speak to one of them. In fact, I am remarkably honored, excuse me, I'm remarkably honored that for my inauguration, one of those mentors is going to come and give the inaugural address. And that is Reverend Dr. Greg Jones. He was the dean of Duke Divinity School when I went down to graduate school there. He was the youngest dean to ever occupy that role. Exceptionally transformative person who cared deeply about those around him, who was wicked smart, who was well published and thoughtful, spent a ton of time researching what it means to forgive and what reconciliation should look like here and around the world. He's going to come back and give an inaugural address here. And the themes for our inauguration weekend are the good of this place. I'm thrilled to have someone who I looked up to. And can acknowledge that all of us are standing on the shoulders of many others that have made this possible. So that's one example of one of my mentors.
Well said. Tell me a little bit just about what you're excited about at Lycoming. And if folks, want to explore opportunities with the advancement group or more broadly, just how to go about that.
Lycoming College, since its founding, has been a place that has been comfortable innovating. There's some institutions, and you might be have encountered some of them as well, Brent, but that operate in a way where they want to insulate themselves from what's going on in the world, and not even necessarily in higher education, but money can do that. Money can insulate you from what's happening in the rest of the world. But Lycoming has been an entrepreneurial, innovative type of place from the very beginning, starting as an academy before schools were compulsory, to the first junior college in the state, to a four-year institution, to now one of the U.S. News' national liberal arts colleges. And it's that spirit of innovation that is most exciting to me. And to be helping to support and lead a community that wants to be innovative in a time of extraordinary disruption and change within higher education, is what I'm excited about. And all of the forms that will take, we're beginning to uncover and explore what those will be. But no question, it will be on the academic front. It will be in the ways that define, further define what it means to be a learning community, a residential place that takes seriously civil discourse and community building, and how it is that we can differ from one another but still have respect and appreciation for those differences. If 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 uh, If higher education, again, as I've used this theme, can be about anything, it should be a place where we can be in dialogue and do that in a way where we are constructive and we build up one another rather than tear each other down. So being part of a community that takes that seriously is what I'm very excited about.
All right, last question. I want to be respectful of your time, but over the next 10 years, do you think there will be more or fewer presidents with advancement experience? No right or wrong answer.
My immediate thought is probably more. And for many reasons, not simply because advancement officers have the capacity to raise money, but the best advancement officers are good listeners. We understand the importance of knowing how important it is to understand before being understood. And if I learned anything from my time in advancement, listening is incredibly important. And another reminder, it's not about me. I used to joke very early on, because all of us, we want to be recognized. People want to know that we want to know that people know we're doing good work. And I still reference this this movie from years ago, Jerry Maguire. Tell me you don't like Jerry Maguire. I mean, everybody likes Jerry Maguire. So what's that really early scene in Jerry Maguire where he's talking about what he does and who he is and all this stuff? And there's the scene of him helping to sign Drew Bledsoe to the massive contract. And in that picture, all you see is his arm. And that's really what we are called to do in this work, and certainly as advancement professionals, to listen well, to help to champion the needs and the interests of others, to make our institutions a better place. So I credit advancement with helping me to learn that in important ways.
So be comfortable being uncomfortable and be comfortable being the elbow to the hand in the photo.
Cheers. Exactly right, Brad.
Show me the money. Show me the money. All right. Well, you are active on LinkedIn, which I think is probably becoming more and more common among folks in your position. But I would assume if folks are listening and they'd like to connect, that that's an okay way to do it.
I would welcome that. It's the place I'm most active, and so I will be excited and eager to connect with other colleagues.
Well, Chip, I'm grateful for your time and for sharing your journey. And I hope that others raise their sights because you can do this work. You're in a great industry. There's a lot of training ground. Pick up a couple of hobbies and additional side hustles maybe along the way, whether that's music, history, or business. And I would just encourage you to reach out to Chip and please mention that you heard him on the Raise podcast.
Thank you, Brent. It's been a real pleasure and a wonderful time for you and Evertrue and the work that you have done there since our very first time of meeting 15 years ago at a CAES conference. So cheers to you and your colleagues and your commitment to this industry and the inspiration and the direction that you give us. So our
Hey, thank
thanks as
you,
well.
Chip. It means a lot. We're just going to keep putting one foot in front of another and grateful to be on this journey with you. And so, with that, I will close today's episode featuring Chip Edmonds, president at Lycoming College. Thanks, Chip, and take care, everybody.
Take care, Brent.